You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Not all that long ago, when you went on a vacation, you probably sent a postcard to mom, dad, a close friend. Maybe you grabbed one with a photo of the place you were visiting, wrote a quick note on the back. Maybe "Wish You Were Here" was featured on there, slapped on a really cheap stamp. A few days later, it gets delivered. The recipient gets excited with that fun piece of mail, and they get to read the personalized note. Maybe they even saved it and put it in a box. But now that we have smartphones and easy access to email and social media, are postcards still relevant? Our next guest says yes. She's got a new book coming out on the history of postcards, all the different industries that are involved with making them happen, the role they played in the past and present. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you still send postcards? Why or why not? How do you feel when you get them, if you do? Is there a particular postcard you remember sending or receiving? Do you have that treasure trove, a box of your own or someone else's postcards? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lydia Pine is an affiliate researcher in the Institute for Historical Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. She's the author of Postcards, The Rise and Fall of the World's First Social Network. It hits the shelves next week. Lydia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
I mentioned that treasure trove, that box of postcards, maybe from a family member. You had one of those, right?
Yes, I started this project with one of those boxes. And since I've been working on this project, have been gifted with several more. Excuse me. It seems that the once family members find out that you're interested in the postcard project, they keep coming. They recirculate, if you will, which is awesome. But yes, my interest in this project really was sparked by having been gifted this box of postcards from the turn of the 20th century, and looking through postcards that my great-grandfather had received, and just sort of starting to think about all of the different ways that postcards function as a social network.
You write that postcards are the largest class of artifacts that humankind has ever exchanged. Can you give us a sense of the scope, especially in the heyday of the postcard?
Yeah, it really shocked me to realize just how many postcards have been made and sent and printed and read and received going around the world. So historians estimate that in the first two decades of the 20th century, so 1900 to 1920, something like 200 billion, so billion with a B, postcards were in global circulation. And when I came across that, that really set me back to just think about the sheer amount of work and labor and ideas and technology that go into all of the parts that are required to send a postcard. As you said, we have to find a stamp. We have to have it delivered. We have to print it. We have to buy it and send it, and somebody has to receive it. And thinking about 200 billion artifacts in circulation was really mind-blowing for me.
You dig into the meaning of postcards, what it means that we embrace these and sent them. And there's a tip here in your subtitle, our first social network. Can you talk about that idea of sending these cheap postcards, quick, cheap, easy to send, as a sort of social network?
Yeah, one of the things that has been fascinating to dig into with this project is the idea that there's a sender and a recipient. And it's not just sort of performative tourism of, oh, look, here I am, I sent this postcard, and here's my demonstration that I went to this really cool touristy thing. But there's also the sort of material life of the postcard, that it's received. Some people save them, some people don't save them. And there's this sense that that postcards are forming the lines of networking that I think we reenact over a century later with digital social networks like Twitter and Instagram. The idea that there's a post and that people respond to it, or the idea that that there's an image and that it sort of has this sense, like there's a really good sort of Instagram aesthetic. There were really good postcard aesthetics 100 years before. And so I think that there are a lot of the similar ways that social networks function that we think about today. a lot of the precedents for this were set down by this older social network made up of postcards.
One thing that really struck me, I think of postcards mainly as, you know, the thing you send when you travel. They were big in rural America as kind of this lifeline of communication. Can you talk about how it swept rural communities across the U.S.?
Yeah, it's such a fascinating story. So in 1909, the U.S. Post Office was in danger of going bankrupt. That they were something like $17 million in the red, and it was really quite grim. And 2 years later, in 1911, they're actually running a surplus. They're running something like $200,000 of a surplus. And there's this huge question of, well, what happened? What happened in 2 years that could turn around the postal situation like that? And the historian Daniel Gifford had gone through the postal archives to figure out that it's simply the sheer number of postcards that are being bought and sold and sent through the United States Postal Service at that point. And so, excuse me. And so one of the big ways that this really turned was it was establishing connections between rural people in rural America with people in urban America. And so there is this sort of networking effect that's happening.
We're talking to Lydia Pine about her new book out next week, Postcards, The Rise and Fall of the World's First Social Network. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. David is with us in Madison. David, hi.
Yeah, hello. How are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, David?
Just kind of neat. I was going through my dad's stuff, you know, right down to the fishing tackle and the last of the stuff. He passed a while ago. And one of the things that was in there, it was a cardboard, I'd call it a can, and it had like a tin top and a tin bottom to it. And I opened it up, and there was a postcard inside, and it said, send your used gold here. And, you know, they would buy it back for 35 cents an ounce or whatever. But there was a penny postcard in there, so that had to be like from the 30s or 40s maybe. I just thought that was kind of cool with the penny postcard, though.
Interesting, David. Thanks a lot for sharing that. Yeah, Lydia, a lot of postcards were sent for personal communication. A lot of them, you write, were for advertising or business schemes like the one David's dad, it sounds like, ran across.
Yeah, if I could just jump in with that. Yeah. I'm so excited that David had that example to share, because certainly postcards were an incredibly cheap form of advertising. And lots of companies did things like that to advertise either personal businesses or to advertise for their company. And it really was fairly ubiquitous. One of my favorite examples that I folded into the introduction of the book was a postcard that was sent out by a church in Kansas that was reprimanding people for not attending services. And so this idea that there's advertising or there's some sort of like, not just, hey, wish you were here. There's certainly that element to postcards as well.
Yeah, our producer Bill Martin's liked to one that you printed saying, hey, we all felt bad you didn't make it to Sunday school last Sunday. Hope to see you next week.
Exactly.
The guilt card. I love it. Thanks, David, for sharing that with us. We'll go next to Madeline in Rice Lake. Madeline, hi.
Hi. So I just wanted to share a little story of my parents and I. Before I got married, my parents and I took a last trip of me being single, and we went across Lake Michigan in the SS Badger ferry. Mm-hmm. And in the gift shop, they had a thin little wooden postcard. And I thought, I want to send this to my fiance. And it was so cute. I wrote a little letter, and it was such a cute little postcard. I told him, hang on to this, because when we're married and we have our little home, like, I would like to have this as decor. And I have it now in a little cabinet tucked away, kind of cute.
I love it, Madeline. Thank you so much for sharing that. Sentimental value, Lydia, not just for Madeline, but for a lot of people on maybe that particular postcard.
No, exactly. That there really is this sort of resonance in it. And it's not just building any kind of network. It's really building this personal network and this personal connection. And it's sort of like this material manifestation of, hey, here's this thing. And I remember doing this thing. So it's a brilliant example.
Thanks for that call. We're talking about the history and the present of postcards with Lydia Pine. She's an affiliate researcher in the Institute for Historical Studies at the University of Texas at Austin and author of the new book, Postcards, The Rise and Fall of the World's First Social Network. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you send and or receive postcards to this day? Do you have fond memories of doing it in the past? Do you have a collection of your own or maybe a family member's in a box? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Lydia Pine about her newest book, Postcards, The Rise and Fall of the World's First Social Network. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Fountain City. John, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, John?
Years ago, a very good friend of mine started a postcard chain letter, postcard chain letter idea. And he set up groups that you could pick a theme and you would get postcards from all over the world, all over the country. I got a huge stack of them, and it was a great, fun project.
And, John, have you gotten some ones from around the world?
Oh, yeah, from all over Europe, Africa, Soviet Union in those days.
I love it, John. Thanks a lot for sharing that. Lydia, you have been on a postcard sending mission, I understand, as part of your research for the book.
So, as part of the research for the book, but also just out of, I loved sending and receiving postcards as a kid and decided that I wanted to do the same with my nieces and nephews. Who are thoroughly in the Gen Z demographic. And it was this utter novelty when I started doing it a couple of years ago when I started this research project. And it's been really fun for the kids to receive and to start sending them. That's been the other fun thing to sort of build the network back the other way is to be able to have them start sending some postcards to me as well.
Thanks a lot for that call. We had an email from Greg who says his father passed away some years ago, was an avid postcard collector. Greg says he's held on to his collection, not knowing what to do with it, apart from a few he wants to personally keep. He wonders, you know, can you get these appraised? Or can you sell these things or at a minimum donate them so that someone can enjoy them as much as his dad did? There is a collector's market, but there's a lot of postcards out there, right, Lydia?
There are a lot of postcards out there. I know that some public libraries are interested in collections and just sort of building their own picture archives. Some historical associations are interested in building those. Some folks opt to sort of disassemble personal collections like that through eBay or Etsy. So I think that those seem to be the most popular, the popular options for what to do with the collection if you don't want to keep the shoebox.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Susie is on the line in New Berlin. Hi, Susie.
Hi. Postcards are really important to me. And as an art teacher and an art therapist, I use postcards a lot. But here's one thing. In talking to a friend of mine, we haven't lived near each other since we were 18, but have known each other for 59 years now. And she just told me that she has saved every single postcard and letter I have ever written to her.
Aww.
And so, and I remember writing a lot of those postcards from, you know, family vacations all the way up until taking our kids on family vacations, you know, and I stopped sending them too much these days, but still send them once in a while. So anyway, she's got my life in a shoebox.
Susie, thank you so much. That reminds me, Lydia, a big point you make is, you know, a postcard on a shelf is one thing, but it really becomes something based on, you know, what we do with it, who we send it to, the message we write, and what they do with it when they get it.
Yeah, one of the things that's been really interesting about this project is the sense that I tell people about it, and the first thing folks say usually is, well, does anybody send postcards anymore? And the answer is emphatically yes, people do send postcards. So for example, in the last couple of elections, postcards to voters have been really popular. There are programs that you can arrange to have postcards sent on your behalf. People still send them sort of almost in defiance of fast communication to say, look, here, we can celebrate the slowness of a postcard. And so it's really neat to see people, I think, embracing the qualities that postcards offer. They don't offer the speed of an Instagram post, but they offer sort of that material connection, the idea that here's this thing and it took this effort and I thought of you.
Thanks so much for sharing that story. We'll go to Amanda next in De Pere. Amanda, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I like to use the cheesy postcards from the 80s, draw pictures on them, and write jokes for my 6-year-old nephew and send them through the mail. And he just loves the surprise when the postman brings it.
Is this something you've been doing over, I don't know, over the COVID time?
Definitely during the COVID time. And he's just learning how to read. He's in kindergarten. So it's a great way for him to practice those letters.
I love it, Amanda. Thanks a lot for telling us about that. Lydia, what do you think of the story?
Oh, that's brilliant. I think that there's a huge historical precedent for it. Not only is it just really cool and an amazing thing to be doing, but you're tapping into this sort of 150 years of postcards to do it.
Thanks, Amanda, for sharing that with us. We're talking to Lydia Pine about her new book, Postcards, The Rise and Fall of the World's First Social Network. Back to your calls now. We've got Paul with us in Toma. Paul, hello. Are you there, Paul?
Yeah. Hi.
Hi. You had a story for us, I think, Paul. What did you want to tell us about?
Yeah. Well, when my son was in Cub Scouts way back in the mid-90s, I started a program, helped him do a program for his national requirement for one of his badges. And what we did is we contacted, sent out postcards to all 50 governors and had them sign a card and send it back to us that said, peace through cooperation. It was because back in the day, presidents became presidents either being governors, senators, or congressmen. But as a result, like I said, he got 47 out of 50.
Wow!
And the three, only three of them didn't respond because we were outside of the state. That was back when we were in Louisiana. So,
I got to ask, did you keep those, or did he keep those?
We did for a very long time. Then I became homeless for a while, and I had them with me, and they got lost to the wind. But they were quite the collection. We had Mario Cuomo back in the day, and we had we got a letter from President-elect Clinton, and we got one from the replacement governor of Arkansas, and several of the governors were either died within a year or were convicted. That was kind of. Oh,
thanks a lot. I'm sorry you ran into hard times and had to give those up, but a great story still, Lydia. I love that, writing to public officials and getting responses from most of them.
That's fantastic. I think it really speaks to sort of the ubiquity and the flexibility of postcards as a medium, to be able to have all of these different ways for postcards to be sent and received and to have them intersecting people's lives. I love it.
Thanks for sharing that with us, Paul. We've got Dick on the line in La Crosse now. Dick, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I remember postcards. I was a little farm boy in Iowa back in the 50s. And I would get a postcard from my grandparents who would travel to California. And I would get a picture of the Golden Gate Bridge. Or when they went to Mount Rushmore, it would be Mount Rushmore. And so it was the best pictures I ever saw of those kind of historical figures from throughout the states when they traveled. And so I just thought that was very special to have them think of me. But I also got to see something that they saw that was kind of an icon.
I love it, Dick. Thanks for sharing that. And I'm also glad he called Lydia because you reminded me. I wanted to ask you about, you know, how places are represented in these postcards that people like Dick's grandparents were sending.
Oh, that's a fantastic segue. And there are two things that come to mind with that. One, certainly there are these famous places like Mount Rushmore or the Brooklyn Bridge or the Eiffel Tower or things like that that become really codified as tourist stops. Through postcards. It's like, hey, I went to this place and I am going to send you this postcard of this famous thing. But there's also, in the early 20th century, postcards are also serving a role in sort of early photojournalism, where real picture postcards that look, that are basically just pictures that are printed on postcard stock, are a alternative or an option for the sort of early days of photojournalism. And so for things like the Mexican Revolution or for political rallies and protests and things like that of the early 20th century, postcards become a way of dissembling and being able to sort of make people aware of places and of things that are happening there.
Just in our last minute, you know, 20 years from now, we're not going to open up that box of Instagram posts. Do you worry that we're losing something if a lot of that kind of a quick communication is in this non-physical form that, that postcards were?
That's an interesting question. And I would say yes and no. That, yes, yeah, certainly, I hope that nobody's printing out my Instagram posts to save the way, you know, I would hope that people would save a postcard. But I also look at how many postcards have been lost, right? That we don't have those 200 billion postcards still with us. And so I think that there will be some things that sort of filter through and are saved. And that's pretty neat.
Lydia, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us again.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That's Lydia Pine, affiliate researcher in the Institute for Historical Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. We talked to her about her new book. It's called Postcards, The Rise and Fall of the World's First Social Network. Hits the shelves here in the U.S. on December 21st. Love to hear more of your postcard stories. You can share them over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Maybe even you can share a picture of one that you've kept or found in that treasure trove from a relative. Again, you can share that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I think we'll have more stories to share later this week. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the U.S. Surgeon General is raising concerns about the mental and emotional well-being of younger Americans. Two Wisconsin experts join the show for a look at the problem and possible solutions. Plus Food Friday, and it's time to bake some cookies. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, there are continuing concerns about inflation in the U.S. economy and around the world. The Federal Reserve is looking at possible action. We'll get to the basics on what the Fed is and what powers it has when it comes to inflation, what it all means for prices you might pay in the year to come. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up after the recent settlement for victims of Larry Nassar, an expert on athletic programs tells us how sports organizations can be built better to prevent harassment, abuse, and cover-ups in the future. First, Federal Reserve officials said yesterday that the U.S. may be in store for 3 increases in interest rates next year because of concerns about inflation. It'll be a change because interest rates have been near zero throughout the pandemic. And whether you've got money in a savings account or you're trying to pay down a credit card, it all could have a big impact on you. We're taking a closer look at how these interest rates work and why they matter to your wallet. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about inflation? Are you feeling it when you buy stuff? What do you think about the idea of these possible interest rate increases coming next year? You're paying off a lot of credit card debt, worried about having to pay higher interest rates in the future? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Taylor Tepper is a senior financial analyst with Forbes Advisor. He's a personal finance journalist who's covered a range of financial topics in the New York Times, Newsweek, Fortune, and elsewhere. Taylor, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thank you so much. It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, we see in the headlines all the time, Federal Reserve is doing a thing. Can you give us a quick 101? What is the Fed? What's its job?
The Fed is the nation's central bank, and its job is 2 things. It's to maximize employment and to keep prices stable. So that basically means it wants to get as many people working as possible without running inflation too high for too long.
And one side of that equation has people worried right now, the inflation side. Can you remind us of some of the numbers we're seeing out there?
Yeah. Inflation is at about a 39-year high, if you look at the consumer price index. And even using sort of the inflation gauge that the Fed prefers to use, it's extremely high. It's over twice as high as the Fed thought it would be this time last year. So consumers are not crazy. Prices are higher, and they're much higher than the Fed thought they would be, even as early as this spring.
And I want to talk about the T word here, transitory. The Federal Reserve folks were saying this. And the tricky thing is, yes, it's a thing that'll go away. Does that mean next week or next year or next decade? It sounds like the Federal Reserve is stopping using that word now. Why is that?
Well, because they were wrong. I mean, basically, that was it. They thought that they were never very, you know, specific about inflation would be transitory for like 6 months or 9 months or 7 months and 2 days. But the general cut and thrust of it was there would be a ramp up in inflation as the economy got going, because you're comparing 2021 prices with a growing economy to 2020 prices when the economy was depressed. And eventually, as the year went on, it would work itself out and things would get more normal. And that was just wrong. Like, the inflation is growing. It's becoming more broad based. It's become more embedded in various parts of the economy. And so now the Fed has said that they're going to stop using that word because it wasn't very descriptive or effective or true, and start sort of believing that inflation is sort of more long lasting, at least in sort of their outward expressions. And that's why they have interest rates potentially rising at least three times next year.
Talking to Taylor Tepper with Forbes Advisor about the Federal Reserve, inflation, and interest rates. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Taylor, that takes us to this tool you just mentioned, the interest rates. Why would the Federal Reserve be increasing interest rates as a tool against inflation? How does that work?
So basically, I mean, just think about it in terms of sort of gas and brakes, right? So when the economy is bad, and everyone is sort of doesn't want to spend, and banks don't want to lend, and you know, things are really gummed up, the Fed will cut interest rates to sort of stimulate the economy. And that's what it did in 2020, right? And that's what it did after the Great Recession, brought interest rates down to zero. And when that gets going a little too fast, and people are a little worried that inflation is going a little too high, then they'll start tapping on the brakes. And right now, that involves something called tapering, which was they're slowing the pace of these bonds that they've been buying. That's like a small way. It sort of helps the economy. But the big way it taps the brakes is by raising interest rates, because it just makes it more expensive to borrow money. And that sort of crimps the general animal spirits of the economy. So, and that's sort of what it's planning. The interesting thing is, and the reason the Fed believes that it can tap the brakes sometime next year, is that employment, the labor market, it's pretty tight right now. You know, like McDonald's has to offer bonuses to people to sign up. So in that way, it's feeling somewhat confident. But I would offer a little note of caution that we may not actually see the three hikes that the Fed is talking about. One, because the labor market, while it's tight, there are a lot of people not working in jobs that were working before the pandemic, right? So something called like the labor force participation rate of prime age workers, which is like 25 to 54, that's down. It's down substantially from before the pandemic, before the recession. And so that means that there's a lot of people out there who could work, and you know, a lot of them are sort of women who are taking care of kids because school has been so messed up with the pandemic and all of these sort of crazy things that families had to do to sort of deal with life now. And if life gets more back to normal, those people will get back into the labor force. And so the Fed may think that, you know, the labor force has a little bit more, you know, needs to grow a little bit more before it taps on the brakes. So it's sort of this, you know, it's a push and pull thing between wanting to get as many people working as possible without causing inflation to run too high.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Michael is with us in Milwaukee. Michael, hello.
Hi. Hello. A couple of things. As far as inflation, I'm not concerned about it. And these are different times right now. This isn't normal inflation. And it isn't only inflation. We could be concerned about it here if it was inflation in our country. But this is worldwide inflation and has caused mainly by this coming out of this COVID lockdown and all this stuff. And it's going to take years for the economy worldwide to get back to normal. That being said, as far as the rate increases, they are long overdue. Having 0% interest or just about 0% interest is not the a sign of a healthy economy if you got to keep boosting it at the expense of other people. Myself being a senior citizen, we depend upon interest from our meager savings to survive on, and a quarter of a percent interest just doesn't cut it. And it really hasn't helped with home buying and stuff like that, because if you watch what happened, when the interest rates are down ridiculously low as what they have been over the past quite a few years, home prices have skyrocketed. So that really hasn't helped. In fact, it's probably hurt the consumer more than helped them because of the cost increases and things. So that's just my opinion.
Michael, thanks a lot for the call. Well, you gave us a lot to work with there, Taylor. I want to launch from his last point there, the impact of low interest rates on the housing market. Now, the Federal Reserve interest rate isn't exactly the mortgage interest rate, but they are related, as I understand it. What do you think of that notion that these low interest rates driving up the cost of housing, which is part of our inflation?
Yeah. So I would say that the more important interest rate number for mortgages is the 10-year Treasury yield, more than the federal funds rate. And the 10-year Treasury yield isn't controlled by the Fed. It's controlled by the bond market. And right now, the yield is very, very low because basically the bond market doesn't think that the economy is going to grow very fast in the long term. And they don't think the economy is going to grow very fast in the long term because of severe, long-term trends. Like, it's an aging population, there's technological development. And so that has more to do with interest rates being really low. To your caller's point, mm-hmm. Housing prices were depressed for a long time after the Great Recession, even though interest rates were really low. So it's just because interest rates were really low doesn't mean housing prices are going to go skyrocket. The reason housing prices are expensive now is because there's not that many houses available. People aren't building that many houses. And that's a different trend, a different problem altogether. So I would say that, for mortgages, that's more tied to the 10-year, and the 10-year has stayed stubbornly low because the bond market just doesn't think the economy is going to keep growing as fast as it's growing in 2021.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Taylor Tepper, senior financial analyst with Forbes Advisor, with us today to break down the Federal Reserve, how it tackles inflation, and why changes in the interest rate can matter to us. We'll get into more of that in just a bit. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How have interest rates impacted you? Are you worried about inflation? You feeling those costs? Do you want to see the Federal Reserve take action and increase those rates in the hopes of slowing down inflation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our look at how changes in interest rates impact you. News from the Federal Reserve yesterday that there may be 3 interest rate increases coming up next year to deal with ongoing inflation concerns. Taylor Tepper stays with us from Forbes Advisor. You can call in with your thoughts, your questions, your experiences with inflation, your thoughts on the impact of very low interest rates at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Here's Fed Chairman Jerome Powell talking yesterday about easing up the Fed's stimulus efforts.
We are phasing out our purchases more rapidly because with elevated inflation pressures and a rapidly strengthening labor market, the economy no longer needs increasing amounts of policy support.
Taylor, I want to follow up on something else our caller Michael brought up. He says, hey, a senior relying on interest rates from savings, very low interest rates, sees the current low interest rates hurting his retirement years. Can you talk about who is helped or hurt by lower or higher interest rates?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So if you have money in your bank account, that is, you are hurt, like your caller said. Incidentally, though, just because the Fed raises rates doesn't mean that banks will automatically or very quickly start raising the yield that you get on your savings. So I would just have a word of caution there that it's not, the banks take their time in passing that onto its customers. And then so when interest rates are like rise, debt holders, if you have credit card debt, for instance, you start paying more. The APR is tied to the federal funds rate. And so if you have, you know, credit card debt, if you've sort of, especially after Christmas, then you could be looking at a higher bill. So that's generally who loses.
How about things like, are adjustable rate mortgages still a big thing like they were in the lead up to the housing crash and Great Recession? Is this something that could hurt people with particular kinds of mortgages?
Less so. I think that's been sort of less popular over time, especially after that crunch. So I think, you know, if you sort of have a mortgage and you haven't sort of refinanced into a lower rate mortgage, given the low mortgage rate going on right now, it's been going on for the past year or so. I think for a certain period of time, it was the 30-year fix was below 3%. That might be something to look into, but that's sort of more prevalent for people now.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Jerry is with us in Viola. Jerry, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to ask about, Jerry?
I'd like to know, is the Fed a government agency or is it a privately owned institution?
Jerry, great question. My answer, Taylor, is yes. A little of both, am I right?
Yeah, I mean, so they're government servants. The Fed chair is nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate, but it's independent. So once the Senate confirms whoever the president nominates, the Fed chair acts independently and isn't controlled by any sort of other body of government. And that was sort of like the interesting thing you sort of see over the course of time, presidents sort of get a little frustrated with Fed chairmen and who raise rates in the middle or near elections. So you kind of see that. But typically, you try and the Fed tries to be as apolitical as possible. That's why you don't really see Powell doesn't really support legislation, with rare exceptions. And so they really try to be separate. And that's actually one reason why I think people should be a little cautious about there definitely being three rates hikes next year, because one of those potential windows when they could raise rates is September, and September is pretty close to the November midterms. And I wonder if the Fed may want to not sort of step in or make any sort of policy action while, you know, people start casting votes, especially early on. So that might be one reason why the Fed doesn't act as aggressively as people think right now.
You mentioned that the idea of raising interest rates is kind of like the brakes in your car to slow things down. Is there any signal from the Federal Reserve if they're going to be like tapping those brakes or slamming on them if and when we do see these interest rate increases?
Powell has been very, very deliberate. He talks a lot. He's very communicative. It's very easy to know what he thinks. He has been wrong. You know, he was wrong about transitory. But, you know, in August of 2020, he gave this speech about the Fed sort of welcoming somewhat higher inflation than 2%, and which is just to say that the Fed is going to be very deliberate about what it does, but what it's going to do. And right now, it's been telling people that it's going to taper more quickly. So that should run its course in April. And then maybe in June, they'll consider raising rates depending on what happens with COVID and people going back to work and inflation. So I don't think you should worry about, you know, like a 1994 situation where, you know, they rapidly raise rates and no one knows what's happening. The Fed is going to make it as sort of gradual as possible.
Taylor, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us again.
It's my pleasure, and go Packers.
That's Taylor Tepper, a Packer fan apparently, and senior financial analyst with Forbes Advisor, and a personal finance journalist who's covered a wide range of financial topics in a variety of outlets. He was with us today to break down the Federal Reserve, what it is, how it works, how its changes to interest rates can impact you, and how it's trying to deal with current concerns about inflation. A new business is capitalizing on a legal loophole that permits the sale of cannabis in Wisconsin. The products isolate a part of the hemp flower that has many of the same qualities as illegal marijuana. Three Tall Pines Farm is one of the companies finding there's a big market for these products, even as marijuana remains illegal in the state. Rob Mentzer reports.
It's warm. Come on in.
The fans are running in the greenhouse at Three Tall Pines Farm. It's a cool November morning in Sheboygan County, but inside it's about 78 degrees. Grower Joe Duchateau gives a tour.
In the center we have our Pine Walker, and then the back half here we have what's called the Forbidden Five strain.
These are hemp plants that the farm will turn into a legal form of cannabis that's sold across Wisconsin. Three Tall Pines is capitalizing on a boom in what are called Delta 8 products. They have the same intoxicating effects as illegal weed, but they're not regulated in Wisconsin. Duchateau is a strong believer in the medicinal qualities of hemp, both the non-intoxicating CBD products and the THC products that do produce a high.
I got into this about 2 years ago because you can see it, I have this cyst on my wrist that I'm a golfer and it's caused me a lot of pain over the years. And I was given some CBD topical to try and it essentially took away the pain in my hand.
Federal law forbids the sale of the specific type of THC contained in marijuana called Delta 9. It doesn't say anything about closely related Delta 8 THC. Chris Lindsay is the vice president for policy at the U.S. Cannabis Council, which lobbies for the legal marijuana industry.
If you go back and look at your farm bill, it says no Delta 9 THC. It doesn't say no Delta 8 THC. So what a lot of these folks said was, hey, looks like we have an open lane.
There's definitely a demand for the products. In Wisconsin, Delta 8 is now sold in head shops, health food outlets, and even gas stations. Craig Thrawn, who owns Three Tall Pines, says last November they sold their first pound of hemp for $100. Business has skyrocketed since they started selling Delta 8.
We might break $2 million this year, the first year. And we're pushing to do it.
Of course, the popularity of the products is also cause for concern to law enforcement and health officials, and even some producers. In states with legal marijuana, there are strict regulations and inspections. That's not the case with Delta 8.
Right now, there is no regulation, so it is Wild West.
Jeremy Smith is owner of a company called Tabby's that makes Delta 8 mints. He also runs the lab for Three Tall Pines Farm. He says he's proud of the care they take to ensure their products aren't tainted with harmful chemicals, but he acknowledges that not everyone is as careful.
This industry has zero regulation right now, and it's getting to the point where it needs it.
In September, the Federal Food and Drug Administration issued a lengthy warning about health risks associated with the products, and legal marijuana groups like Lindsay's have come out against Delta 8. Lindsay says he worries about a public backlash if any of the products now circulating turn out to contain harmful chemicals.
As this continues to get more popular, if it's not regulated, what do you expect?
And there are recent examples of unregulated products doing harm. In 2019, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention investigated a national outbreak of lung injuries. They believe they were caused by a chemical that was popular in unregulated vaping fluids, including THC products. Thrawn agrees that the business needs regulation, and for him, Delta 8 products are not the end point. He thinks the future of the industry lies in medical applications, not recreational or what he calls rec products.
We understood that the end product for us is going to be the medical industry, but in order to get there and to get the equipment, to purchase the equipment, to have a business that's thriving, we got to play rec. So we're playing rec, but we're also developing medical products.
For now, though, Thrawn says Three Tall Pines is continuing to expand its Delta 8 business. They're launching new edible products and building new greenhouses so they can grow hemp all year round. Rob Mentzer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, if you had to start from scratch to form a large sports organization, a national team for the Olympics or a college athletic department, how would you do it? What would you want to improve from current institutions? We talk about what could be done differently to give athletes more protection and more power. This after a series of abuse scandals and the announcement of a settlement from the U.S. Gymnastics Organization and the Olympic Organization for gymnasts who suffered abuse by a doctor for years. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. This is the Ideas Network.